How's doing? This is all of us who are on vacation right now, so you're stuck with me this morning, and all those who don't care about soccer, because the World Cup final is right now. 15 minutes ago it started. So if I check my phone every now and then, that's why. I'm just kidding. If you get up now and leave, I'm not offended, because I just reminded you it's okay if you leave. My name is Doug Walker. I'm the pastor of students here at the Jennersville campus. I'm excited to be here with you guys this morning. And love working here at Willowdale Chapel. On Tuesdays here at Willowdale Chapel, it's our staff meeting day. Everyone from both campuses, we all meet at the Kennett campus on the church site, and we talk about what's going on, some ministry wins, what's been happening individually within us, and where are we going as a church in the next season, just big kind of ministry planning sessions. And routinely, every single Tuesday, the guys will head out for lunch. We'll walk into town, into Kennett Square, and we'll head over to the marketplace, which has five different restaurants inside of it. So that way, you know, if you are hankering for Mexican food or American food or whatever, there's plenty of choices. But every single Tuesday, all the guys end up at the same spot every single time. We go to Buddy's. And Buddy's, they have the best burgers, the best fries. Do not argue with me about that, although I would like to talk to you about it later if you have a better burger or fry. But they have the best burgers and fries. And on Tuesdays, they have the hot dog special, and it's a dollar hot dog. And it sounds disgusting, and it probably is, but it's really, really good. And we get everyone will get two hot dogs, all the toppings they want to get, and a side of fries for like $4, and it's amazing. Later in the day, though, we pay for it. But it's really good in the moment. And all the guys, we're hanging out, we're eating lunch, and I'm there, Johnny Johnson's there, Larry Redmond's there, my brother's there, a bunch of the guys on staff are there. My brother asked a really good question, and the question was, if you could buy any car, if money weren't an issue, and you could buy any car for practicality, what would you get? Because if you think about it, like, if you have all the money in the world, you can buy anything. There's crazy cars out there, but for practical reasons, this question for me was a really interesting one. And I immediately thought, oh man, like if I had all the money in the world, didn't matter, practicality, I would buy a Land Rover. Love Land Rovers. I would love to own one day. Ever since I was in elementary school, I thought Land Rovers were the coolest cars. But then Larry Redmond, being the wiser, smarter man that he is, gave the best answer. In terms of practicality, money's not an issue. His answer was a Tesla. And a Tesla, they're just, the brand is so cool. I was in California last fall with Johnny Johnston. We were there on a work conference type thing in Pasadena, California. And we were walking around killing time one night, walking through Old Town Pasadena and walking into stores. And we found ourselves walking into a Tesla store. This was the first time I've ever like seen one and actually walked into it. And this, so for the first time in my life, I sat down in a Tesla. And when you sit down in a Tesla, you know you have basically made it at that point. Like, I mean, it is just the nicest car. It is sleek. It is clean. It is innovative. It looks futuristic. It looks like it belongs in some, like, Space Odyssey X magazine. It doesn't belong here on Earth, but it does. I mean, it's just an awesome, nice, classy car. But people aren't buying the Tesla, the brand, because it's a nice, classy car. There's plenty of nice, classy cars that you can buy. There's plenty to choose from. People are buying a Tesla because of one feature in particular, and that's the autopilot feature. The feature that lets you sit in the car and just basically press a button and not have to touch the steering wheel. I've been reading stories about people who have been driving Teslas because I'm so, just like, my mind is blown about the technology of this car. I like reading about it. And I was reading articles about people who are now at the point where they trust the car so much, they trust the autopilot feature so much that they don't even sit in the driver's seat anymore. They just like sit in the passenger seat, in the back seat, like being chauffeured to feel like a VIP or whatever. Like, I mean, like, people don't even sit in the driver's seat anymore because they trust the car so much. I read one article though about a guy who, it took him a long time to actually trust the autopilot feature, which is, again, this is the reason why you buy the car, is the autopilot feature. But it took him, he said, months to actually trust this feature. And so for a long time, he said he would sit at the wheel, turn on autopilot, and just like loosen his grip, but his hands were still around the wheel because he didn't trust that the car was going to do what it needed to do. I read another article about how a guy, he had a heart attack and he was not able to drive himself to the hospital. He just couldn't. He didn't have the strength to do it, didn't have the resources, abilities, but he owned a Tesla. And he managed to get himself in the car, and he told the car, I don't even know how autopilot works. I don't know if it's like Knight Rider or what, but he got in the car, and he somehow tells the car, go to the hospital. And it took him to the hospital, and it saved his life. I mean, the autopilot feature is so incredibly cool, and this is why people are buying a Tesla, because now there is a car that is totally in control. Totally in control. Every other car in the world, every other car ever made other than a Tesla has one commonality among them. Every single one. Doesn't matter if it's a new car, an old car, an ugly car, a nice car. It doesn't really matter. Every single car has one common thread. And that common thread is that every single car is dependent on the driver. The car will function better or worse depending on who is driving it. Right, so if you're driving a car and you make a decision to slam on the brakes, eventually you're going to have to get new brakes. If you are driving a car and you decide to speed, you could get a ticket. If you decide to accelerate really quickly, really fast in a way that your car's not performed to do so, you can hurt the engine. And over time, you are hurting that car. It's up to you if you want to use the turn signal. It's up to you if you fall asleep at the wheel. I don't know. I'm thinking of random things, but it's up to you. The driving of the car is dependent on you. The Tesla is not dependent on you. That car is in total control. And like the guy in the one article who was really afraid to let autopilot do the thing it's supposed to do, think about that for a second. That's a scary moment. The first time I would imagine you driving a Tesla would be a very scary moment when you turn that autopilot on. Is the car gonna like slow down when there's a car in front of me? Is it gonna make that turn slowly? Is it gonna know that there's a car in my blind spot? Like there's a lot of things that go through our heads and we get scared that there is something in control and we're not. We don't like to not be in control. We wanna be the one holding the wheel. But the problem is we're human and we're prone to making really dumb decisions, like not seeing someone in our blind spot, losing focus. Anyone in here ever like drive home from work, their 30-minute drive, and you do it every single day? You get in the car, you get home, and you get into your garage, and you go, how did I just get here? Like, I don't even remember the drive home. Like, I just like we just zone out. But the Tesla car is in total control of everything that's going on. It is not dependent on the driver. It's dependent on itself. That's why people buy that car. We're in the middle of a series this morning called Rest. And God has called us biblically to rest. It is a biblical command for us to rest. And we live in a world today that goes beyond against that call and command that God has given us to rest. We live in a world that says, man, if you're not working 9 to 5, I mean, if you're only working 9 to 5, you're not doing enough. If your kid isn't in 6 different sport team clubs and extracurriculars, they're not doing enough. If they're not being tutored every single weekend, they're not doing enough. If we're not striving to be the absolute very best version of ourselves, we're not doing enough. That's the world we live in. And God has called his people to live in a counterintuitive way in rest. And we've been looking at what that really means. We've been looking at different stories in the Bible of what God means when he says we need to rest. And we're going to continue looking at this today by looking at Isaiah 30. And we're going to see 3 things in this story that pertain to us resting in God's strength versus resting in our own strength. We're going to see 3 things. We're going to see that there's a problem, there's a prescription for the problem, and there's a promise. A problem, prescription, and promise. That's what we're going to see here today. And before we dive into the text, I want to give you guys some background about what's really going on in this story. Here's what's happening. There's 2 different nations, Assyria and Israel. Assyria and Israel. And at this moment in time, Assyria is a mightier nation than Israel. They're the top dogs. They have the better military. They're the stronger nation, the bigger nation. They have it going on. And war is breaking out against Israel and Assyria. And the war breaks out and Assyria comes down to take over Israel. And the battle's happening. And they end up just defeating the northern part of Israel. Assyria has conquered the northern half. And somehow, we really don't know how this happened, but the southern part has managed to survive. The southern part of Israel has made it out alive, but they really have no more resources. They've given everything they can to just survive that one battle. And so they know at any given moment, at any given point in time, Assyria's going to come back after they've recouped and kind of re-energized. They're going to come back and finish the job that they didn't in the previous battle. And so the people of Israel are sitting in a moment in time of great anxiety, of great worry, of great uncertainty. Their protection has been threatened. Their way of life is now threatened. And they are deeply afraid and fearful. The certainty of their future is now unknown. They don't know when it's going to happen. They just know it's going to happen. And when Assyria comes in, they're going to take the Israelites and they're going to force them to assimilate to their way of life. And if they don't, there's threat of being deported, kicked out of the country, or become a slave, or just be killed. And so the way of life that the Israelites have known for their entire lives is being threatened. The comforts of their lives is now threatened. And the certainty of knowing what's coming in the future is no longer in their control. They have no sense of control. And they're fearful. In 1933, this is post-World War I, before World War II, Germany is experiencing its first republic and things are going really well. People who survived World War I, they're living in peacetime and things are good. They have established a sense of routine and stability in their lives and things are looking well. And they can predict what's going to happen tomorrow. They can predict what's going to happen next week. They know where they go to work. They know what time they get up. They know what time they go to bed. Everything they know about their lives is in their control. But suddenly in 1933, there was a threat to their protection. There was a threat of their way of life. Extremist movements were kind of making their way in, including communism. And if you didn't assimilate to their way of life, that would not be good for you. There was a threat in their very lives, and they were so incredibly fearful. And there's a guy by the name of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He's a theologian, a pastor, and an author, and he saw his congregation in 1933 gripped by this fear. And here's what he says about fear. Fear secretly gnaws and eats away at all the ties that bind a person to God. And when in a time of need, that person reaches out for those ties and clings to them, they break and the individual sinks back into himself or herself, helpless and despairing. Fear makes us forget who God is. Fear takes our gaze away from God and turns our gaze onto ourselves. Fear takes our trust away from God and places our trust into ourselves. Here's what happens in Isaiah 30. Let's look at verse 1 through 5 together. What sorrow awaits my rebellious children, says the Lord. You make plans that are contrary to mine. You make alliances not directed by my spirit, thus piling up your sins. For without consulting me, you have gone down to Egypt for help. You have put your trust in Pharaoh's protection. You have tried to hide in the shade. So here's what they do. The Israelites find themselves in a situation that of great uncertainty and a lack of self-control, and there's a problem. Someone's going to take them over. And so in their fear, they look away from God and they look onto themselves. They place their trust in themselves. They take their trust away from God and they say, what can we do to ensure the safety of our lives, to ensure the outcome in our lives that we want to have? We see an outcome approaching our way. We don't like that outcome. So we're going to do everything in our strength and resource and in abilities to get the outcome that we want to get. Fear helps us forget who God is. In moments of great uncertainty and a feeling of all hope is lost, we look to ourselves for the strength that we need to get through that moment. And so that's what Israel does. Here's what they do. They're scrambling. They're trying to figure out, what do? We have no more resources. We only have we have some cattle, but not much. We have some money, but not much. But we need someone to come to our aid and help us out and free us from the onslaught that Assyria is going to come and bring to us. So here's their prescription. They decide, you know what? We have a prescription and a solution for this problem. We're going to go to another country, another nation, and they're going to help bail us out of this thing. And so they're scrambling. Who can help us? Who's another mighty nation that will come to our aid? And they settle on the nation of Egypt. And I don't know if you know anything about the history of the Bible, but Egypt is not the best person to go to. Previous to this part of the story, at one point in time, The Israelites were slaves in Egypt. And God miraculously rescued them from slavery. I don't know if you remember a story where a guy parts an entire sea and the Israelites walk through and then the Egyptians are killed by that water. Yeah, that's the same country we're talking about. And now the Israelites are so desperate. They want to be helped so badly that they even consider going back to Egypt for help. They think that if they go to Egypt, they're going to find life, when in reality, they're going to find death. I mean, even Exodus 1 describes Egypt as a place of death. There was a decree made by Egypt that said, kill every male Israelite. And now the Israelites are in a moment of time of great fear and uncertainty, and to the point where they forget who God is, that God had rescued them at one point, and he could certainly do it again, but they forget all about that, and they say, you know what? We're going to trust in ourselves and our own abilities and our own strength. Let's go to Egypt and see if they'll help us. And this isn't just like them calling up Egypt and going, hey, will you like come over here? No, this is like them traveling through the desert. There's lions and snakes and awful heat that can kill them at any given moment. And there's burglars waiting to rob them. They're taking the rest of the money they have that they lost from Assyria. They're taking all the cattle that they still have from the battle against Assyria. And they're basically placing all of their hope and resources into Egypt, hoping that Egypt is going to rescue them and give them the outcome that they want in life. They see an outcome approaching that they don't want. They decide, you know what? We can figure out how to fix this. We can figure out how to get the outcome that we want. We know how to get from point A to point B, and it requires me and my self-control and my effort and my abilities to get me there. And really what's happening is they're trying to take advantage of an Egyptian strength versus taking advantage of a strength bought for them by God through Jesus. A strength freely given that doesn't require planning, effort, or hard work. And we tend to do the same thing. That when something, a problem comes into our life that just feels like there's absolutely no hope and an outcome is approaching that we do not like, we tend to grow fearful. And in that fear, we forget who God is and we move away from God and we place our trust into ourselves and say, I'm in control of this situation. I know how to get from point A to point B. If I work hard enough, if I plan hard enough, if I can do everything in my power to get me there. And really what we're doing is we're saying, I'm looking for a different Egyptian strength. Instead of resting in the strength that was purchased by God through Jesus for us, a strength that was given to us freely that doesn't require planning, effort, or hard work. But that's what the Israelites are doing. They're forgetting who God is. They're forgetting that God had already miraculously rescued them time and time again. And they go, you know what? We have a prescription, and that prescription is solely dependent upon us and our control over the situation. Let's continue reading verses 1-5. Let's go to the next one. God continues to talk and says, but by trusting Pharaoh, you will be humiliated, and by depending on him, you will be disgraced. For though his power extends to Zoan and his officials have arrived in Hanes, all who trust in him will be ashamed. He will not help you. Instead, he will disgrace you. The Israelites think that, you know, if they just sacrifice enough things, if they have enough wisdom, if they have enough planning, if they have enough attention to detail, that they can achieve their own security. But what they're going to find out is that it doesn't matter how much planning and effort and hard work they put into it, we can never achieve our own sense of security. Apart from God, we can never achieve that security that our heart longs to have. Let's keep reading. Let's keep looking at this story. Verses 12-14. This is the reply of the Holy One of Israel. The reply to basically the prescription that Israel has to their problem. Because you despise what I tell you and trust instead in impression and lies, calamity will come upon you and suddenly, like a bulging wall that bursts and falls. In an instant, it will collapse and come crashing down. You will be smashed like a piece of pottery, shattered so completely that there won't be a piece big enough to carry coals from a fireplace or a little water from a well. Basically, what he's saying there is, you can plan all you want, But apart from me, if you think that resting in your own strength versus resting in my strength, that you can achieve the peace and security that you want in your life, that you can achieve the outcome in a situation and problem that you want to achieve, apart from me, it means nothing. It's completely in vain. And by doing so, you're going to bring in even more stress and more anxiety. It doesn't need to be there. And the story would be really depressing if it ended right there. Like if that was the ending of the chapter, and that's chapter 30, like that would be really sad. That Israel has a problem, they try to fix it on their own, and God says, do whatever you want, you're going to fail. The chapter continues though, and God says, hey, your prescription is not going to work. Your solution to the problem is not going to work. You resting in your own strength is not going to work. But here is what's going to work. Here is the prescription for your problem. Let's look at verse 15. This is what the sovereign, Lord, the Holy One of Israel says. Only in returning to me and resting in me will you be saved. In quietness and confidence is your strength. I mean, think about a situation in your life that just feels like it's out of control. Maybe you didn't get a job that you were really hoping to get. Maybe you didn't get a job promotion that you feel like you should have gotten. Maybe, you know, because you didn't get that job, you can't feed your family and you are literally questioning whether or not you're going to have enough money for the rest of the month to get food for your family. Or maybe someone in your life is super sick and the ending seems real bleak and you just don't have a sense of control over the situation and you can see an outcome approaching that you do not like and you just feel like you have no sense of control and you do everything in your effort to gain that sense of control thinking that will give you peace. When in reality, God is telling us to rest in his strength and in quietness and confidence is his strength. That by returning to God, that'll bring to us this sense of rest in the Lord. And when we rest in God's strength, there is quietness. And in that quietness, there's the absence of frenzy and restless anxiety. And that is the true evidence of a trust in God. That in those moments of uncertainty, in those moments that feel like I cannot get through this thing because I have no sense of self-control, when we place our trust in God, there are fruits from that thing. And that is the absence of frenzy and a restless anxiety. God has called us to live counterintuitive to the rest of the world. The rest of the world, when something hard comes their way, they do everything in their power to control the situation. But God says, no, I don't want you to do that. What I want you to do, instead of trying to get your own control in this situation, place all of your rest and control in my strength. That's the fruit of trust. Think about it this way. It's kind of like quicksand. I have never seen quicksand in real life, never come across it, but I've seen it in enough cartoons to know that it's not a joke, all right? Quicksand is something to be feared. It's a scary thing, not to be messed with. And quicksand, it's kind of like a Tesla. I'm just boggled by it. So I like to do research on it and hear stories about it. And I was looking at quicksand recently, and what I saw was that if you find yourself in quicksand, the human response to wanting to get out of that quicksand is to do everything in your power to get out. You try to look on the ground and see what you can grab a hold of. You look for branches and rocks, just really anything you can dig your hands into to get yourself out. Because quicksand, over time, slowly but surely, just engulfs you to the point where eventually you're just drowning and you die. I mean, quicksand is no joke. It'll take large animals. It'll take humans. It'll take vehicles and cars. It's no joke. It's a scary, scary thing. And if you find yourself in quicksand, that's a real legitimate problem. And you can see the foreseeable future and it doesn't look good. It looks like you're going to die. And it's a really scary moment. And you have no sense of control. You can't get yourself out. And with quicksand, if you fight it, if you try to get yourself out, the problem only gets worse. The more you fight it, the faster you get more engulfed by it. And so the trick to getting out of quicksand isn't doing everything in our own strength to get us out. The trick to quicksand is let yourself get in waist deep. Even if like just like up to here is already just kind of in the quicksand, let yourself get in waist deep. And at that moment, what you need to do is you need to surrender to the quicksand. Give into the strength of what's going on. And so what you have to do is you kind of lean back and you give into it, and more quicksand consumes the upper part of your body, which I'm sure is extremely scary and very fearful, but you let it kind of consume more of who you are. And as you lean back, the quicksand at your feet eventually pushes you up and pushes you out. That in that moment of great fear, instead of trying to take control over the situation, you give into it. You surrender to it. And that is exactly what God is calling us to do. That in the moment of great uncertainty, in the moment of great fear, instead of trying to control the situation and grab a hold of it and telling it what to do and where to go and trying to achieve the outcome that you want to achieve, we need to rest in God's strength and let Him have control. To surrender to Him and give in to Him and trust in Him. In quietness and trust shall be your strength. In quietness and confidence. Here's what John Piper says about this verse. In other words, if you rest in God, if you look to Him instead of dashing down to Egypt, if you trust Him, then He will give you all the strength you need to be patient and to handle the stresses where you are. You see, as humans, our natural reaction to a problem is to go, what can I do to fix this? Right now, right here, what can I do to gain some sense of self-control over this problem? What can I do? What resources do I have? What strength do I have? What abilities do I have to gain the control that I want over this problem right now? That's our human response. But God is saying, do the opposite of that. Place your strength in Me. And as humans, we tend to go, what's my Egypt? Where's the thing that's going to give me my sense of hope to get out of this situation? What's the thing that's going to rescue me and redeem me out of this problem right now? And we go to all sorts of different things to find the security that our hearts long to know. We go to all sorts of different things to give us the peace that our hearts long to know. But God is saying that that peace and that security is not found in anything else. It's not found in your ability to control a situation. It's found in resting in My strength. So we've seen the problem. We've seen that problems come up, and we saw that the Israelites had a problem, that they were going to be taken over, and we saw them try to prescribe a solution for themselves. But of course, that's not going to work. They cannot achieve their own security, no matter how hard they try. But then God says, here is the prescription, and it's not dependent on you. It's utterly dependent upon Me. And if you do place your trust in Me instead of yourself, there are promises that come from that thing. Let's look at the promises. Let's look at verse 18. For those who place their rest in God's strength, here's what God promises. So the Lord must wait for you to come to Him so He can show you His love and compassion. Think about that for a second. The Lord must wait for us to come to Him. Right? Because once we have fear instilled within us, fear takes our eyes off of Jesus and puts them on ourselves. And we say, we can figure this out. And while we're doing that, we have been moving away from God. We are taking our trust away from God. And as we move away from God, God still moves towards us. And He's just there waiting for us to move back towards Him. Why? So He can show His love and compassion to us. For the Lord is a faithful God. Blessed are those who wait for His help. The Lord is a faithful God, that as we're faithless and move away from Him, as we're faithless and say, God, You don't have control over this situation, I have control over the situation. As we're faithless and say, God, I don't trust You, I trust Me. I know better than You. As we're faithless and move away, God is faithful and moves towards us. That's the promise. Because He deeply wants to show His love and compassion for us. But when a trouble and a problem comes into our lives, we quickly forget who God is, and we look to ourselves to figure out how to solve the problem, and we look to Egypt to get us out of there. But God is there waiting for us. Let's keep going. Let's look at the promise even more here in verse 19 through 22. O people of Zion who live in Jerusalem, you will weep no more. in the midst of a problem where you see an outcome approaching you that you do not want to have happen, in the midst of something coming your way that you are unbelievably afraid of and fearful of, you will weep no more, which means you will have joy. Not happiness, because happiness is circumstantial. Happiness is contingent on what's going on in our lives. And if there's a situation coming our way, a problem coming our way, and we can foresee an outcome that is not good, that means we're not going to be happy. But if God promises us that if we rest in his strength, we will weep no more, what that means is we will have joy. Joy is not circumstantial. It's not dependent on whether or not your life is going good or going bad. It's this undescribable joy that just kind of permeates from you, a sense that you know that you are not in control and you are okay with that because God is. A sense of joy because you know I'm not the one in control of this situation. I cannot figure out how to do this on my own, but I know someone who's greater and better than me, and that is God. And there's joy in the midst of that. Let's keep reading it. He will be gracious if you ask for help. Let's go back. He will surely respond to the sound of your cries. God is there waiting for us to ask him for help. But instead, we're asking ourselves for the help. But he's there waiting for us, and he's listening to our cries. Though the Lord gave you adversity for food and suffering for drink, he will still be with you to teach you. Right? Because it doesn't mean that if we're Christians, if we're followers of God, that doesn't mean that life is going to be good all the time. Life is going to be hard. There's going to be challenges. But it's how we handle those challenges that matters. And God says, hey, there's going to be adversity for food and suffering for drink, but I will still be with you to teach you, to take you from point A to point B. If you let go of the steering wheel and let me take over, I will get you there. You will see your teacher with your own eyes. Let's keep reading. Verses 21 and 22. Your own ears will hear him. Right behind you, a voice will say, this is the way you should go, whether to the right or to the left. It's like a GPS. I mean, at this point, it's like a GPS that if we rest in God's strength, he will be telling us where to go, what to do, and how to navigate the problem that arises in our life. You know, before GPS, it was a map, and I've never used a map, so I'm in that generation. But I remember my dad using a map when I was a kid, and he would love to find different ways to get to the beach that we go to every single year, Seattle City, and he would love to find different ways of getting there. And I don't know what he was doing, but he had a highlighter and pens, and I have no clue what it is, but he was mapping out the best way to get there. And then suddenly we had the internet, and we had MapQuest, and you would print out step by step, here's how you do it, which actually, it's pretty dangerous, because what we're doing is we're driving and looking, oh my gosh, the turn, huh? Like, it's not that safe. But it was an upgrade from a map. And then we got a GPS, and there's someone's voice, an eloquent British woman who's suddenly in your car telling you where to go. And you're like, where'd you come from? And she's telling you exactly where to go and how to get there. And now we have Waze, an amazing GPS app that even tells you where a cop is. It tells you, hey, you need to slow down. You're over the speed limit. It tells you there's a pothole coming up. Literally everything that you could ever need to know can be found in that app. And that's what God promises. He says, hey, there's going to be hard times. There's going to be challenges. Just because you're a follower of mine doesn't mean life's going to be easy. It's going to be hard. But if you place your rest in my strength, I will help you navigate that problem. And I will tell you where to go. I will tell you how to handle it. Because God knows the outcome of the problem. We don't know. All we know is what we think is going to happen. And when we see an outcome that we don't want, we go, I don't want that outcome. I want this outcome. And God could certainly place me in that outcome, but I want this one. So I'm going to go this way, and I'm going to go away from God. I'm going to do everything I can in my own power and strength and ability to get that outcome that I want. But in reality, if we got everything that we wanted, man, we would be so messed up. I mean, think about it for a second. If I got everything that I wanted, I would be eating Domino's every single night for dinner, and I'd be sick all the time. But instead, I have a very gracious and awesome wife who makes me broccoli things, and it's delicious. And so I'm not sick. If I got everything I wanted, I'd be a mess. And if I got the outcome that I wanted, I'd be a mess. God knows ultimately what the outcome is, and he knows why he's taking us there and why it's beneficial for us. And like a GPS, he's going to tell us where to go and how to navigate. But that's only a promise if we choose to rest in his strength. Let's keep reading. Then you will destroy all your silver idols and your precious gold images. You will throw them out like filthy rags, saying to them, good riddance. Basically, what he's saying there is all the things you used to place your hope in, all the things that you used to feel security from and comfort in, all those things that weren't me, that you were getting those things from, are going to seem just like garbage. They pale in comparison to the peace that God brings when we rest in his strength. That's the promises. And not only that, God is going to make life abundant for us. Let's keep reading verses 23 through 26. Then the Lord will bless you with rain at planting time. There will be wonderful harvests and plenty of pasture land for your livestock. There's going to be food to eat. There's going to be a good harvest. The oxen and donkeys that will till the ground and eat good grain, its chaff blown away by the wind. In that day when your enemies are slaughtered and the towers fall, there will be streams of water flowing down every mountain and hill. The moon will be as bright as the sun, and the sun will be seven times brighter, like the light of 7 days in one. So it will be when the Lord begins to heal his people and cure the wounds he gave them. When we place our strength in God versus ourself, there's life abundantly. Doesn't mean that life is easy, doesn't mean that life is free of challenges, but there's life abundantly with joy. God hearing our cries, God directing our steps. But that's all contingent on us letting him have control and us resting in his strength. You see, the Israelites were taking advantage of an Egyptian strength versus taking an advantage of a strength that was bought for them by God through Jesus. And we do the exact same thing. That although there was a strength purchased for us through the death of Jesus, we tend to look to an Egyptian strength, something else that will get us out of a problem that feels like there is no solution, that feels like my sense of security is threatened. And we tend to say, all right, I'm going to go to my Egypt. I'm going to go to my thing that'll get me out of this thing, versus saying, God, I trust you. I'm going to follow you. As you have moved towards me, I now move towards you. As you have been faithful to me, I will be faithful to you, because you know better than me. And I don't know what the outcome's going to be. It may be something that I don't like, but you know how to get from point A to point B, and you know the outcome, and whatever outcome it is, it's better for me than the outcome that I had planned. In order to rest in God's strength, we need to surrender control to him. We need to be willing to crucify our fear, because Jesus was crucified to secure our ultimate future. We don't know what our future is going to bring, but God knows. Do you rest in his strength? Are you taking advantage of a strength that was freely purchased for you? A strength that doesn't require planning, effort, or hard work, but that was freely given to you through the death of Jesus. Let's pray. Father God, thank you for the promises of resting in your strength. That God, we as humans, we want to have control. We like knowing where we're going. We like knowing how we're getting there. But God, problems arise in our life, and challenges come our way that make it difficult to predict the outcome. And so God, our human response is a sinful one, and our human response is to say, I know what's better for me than you. I want to do what I want to do, and I want to get to where I want to get based on my own strength. And God, we confess that sin to you today, that we do not know better than you, that you know ultimately what is best for us. And that God, as we rest in your strength, there are promises of real joy. Not circumstantial happiness, but real, meaningful, lasting joy that only comes as we follow you and trust in you. That there is life abundant. that you are listening to our cries and you are telling us which way to go. So God, we confess that we place our trust in ourselves and not in you. God, I pray that you would help us to place our trust in you, solely dependent upon you today. That we would trust the outcomes that you have planned for us and the challenges that you bring into our life. Amen.